listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, it may seem obvious that diagnostic health screenings are a good thing, but it turns out that after a certain age, they can do more harm than good. Right now, an ongoing series of investigative reports looks at a group of barrel recycling plants in the Milwaukee area. Over a year ago, reporters found dangerous working conditions, a lack of safety protocols, and environmental hazards at the plants. Recently, they spoke with St. Francis residents about how emissions from one of the facilities affect their lives and their health. John Diedrich is a reporter and an assistant editor on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigative team. He's been working on the paper's series called Burned. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You and a handful of other reporters at the Journal Sentinel have been covering these plants for almost a year now. What did you originally find that started this series looking into these barrel plants?
Well, this industry is little known. I think that's fair to say, and the risks that we found were high, but not a well-known industry. This is an industry that refurbishes 55-gallon drums. Those are the drums that could carry anything from vegetable oil to chemicals, paints, things of that nature. And these drums, which we sort of are all accustomed to, come back to plants to be reused and refurbished and sometimes recycled. And same thing with big plastic totes, is what they're called, containers that are used for this matter. And so the investigation started when we heard from a whistleblower, somebody who was a safety consultant actually hired by the company, Container Lifecycle Management, to come in and assess the risk in their plant and what needed to be done to improve some safety hazards. And what he saw startled him in terms of lack of safety and also the lack of commitment on the part of the company to change anything. And he was so concerned about that he became a whistleblower and started recording secretly the safety managers for the company describing dangerous conditions, chemicals being mixed together and chemicals being burned off into the surrounding areas, unsafe work conditions for employees and for residents living nearby. And so as we dug in deeper, we took that as the beginning point and then dug in deeply looking at records for this industry, not just here in Wisconsin, but across the country.
And so the specific company that you're looking at in the Milwaukee area is Mid-America Steel Drum, correct?
That's right. It's the name of the company as it's locally known. The corporate name is Container Lifecycle Management, which is unknown to most people, but Mid-America is the name that has been on these facilities for years and continues to be. That is facilities in St. Francis, Oak Creek, and Milwaukee.
So as you said, you looked at the effects on employees and nearby residents, and these plants do a lot of burning, and those emissions are an issue for people living in the neighborhoods around them. And you spoke to several residents near the Mid-America plant in St. Francis, and what stories did they have to tell you about living next to the plant or near the plant?
Well, these facilities, the burning operations, are part of the reclamation or refurbishing process of the drums. So they come in and the material, they're supposed to be empty, and this is sort of the big rub, is they come in with material inside of them, and that is, according to our whistleblower and safety consultant and also employees, that they're coming in with material inside of them. But in any case, through the process, when they are being cleaned out and refurbished and prepared for reuse, they're put through a thermal oxidizer, which burns off what material is left in there. And that material is then released into the adjoining area and nearby area. And as you mentioned, the residents, particularly in St. Francis, live quite close to the facility. There's houses that literally join the property line. And so they are experiencing a lot of problems with smells, and the smells are really dependent on the wind. And so, and these have gone on for a long time. The corporate name of that entity has changed over time, but they've done similar operations for more than. The complaints have gone on for more than 15 years. And the smells that they pick up from there could be anything from industrial paint smells to what's being burned, because they also paint the drums themselves. Mm-hmm. all that gets sort of mixed together into this exhaust system and expelled over the neighborhoods. And it's quite describing, they describe it as, you know, just really makes living in the neighborhood quite unpleasant, and that the smoke comes out, and sometimes it'll just literally lay on the ground and obscure the grass. It's such a heavy, white, opaque smoke that's coming out of the smokestack, forcing them inside and closing all the windows and just making life quite miserable for them in those days.
Well, and several people also told you that they or their family members have experienced health problems that they can't obviously pin directly on the emissions, but it seems pretty likely that there's some connection.
Well, so it is. There are a number of people who've experienced various health issues, and these are subchronic ailments, things like nasal problems, headaches, dizziness, peripheral neuropathy, which is tingling in the fingers and toes, or numbness, things of that nature. And so, and they can't explain what it is, though when they're nearby, you know, when they're near the plant, things seem to be worse. And this is something we were interested to see, was there some detail of that, you know, or some proof of that. And so we at the Journal Sentinel hired a industrial environmental testing company to come up and do testing from of the air in the nearby area, and they were set up for more than a week, and during that time they identified volatile organic chemicals in the area and at levels that would constitute a nuisance, and also that would constitute contributing to subchronic ailments like these I mentioned. And it's important to note that the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, which on their own, independently of ours, did their own testing, and they identified some of these same VOCs, pollutants, essentially chemical pollutants that are in the area. And those may be contributing. I should note that EPA continues to research the possible health effects of this particular, these emissions.
We're talking with John Diedrich. He's a reporter and assistant editor on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigative team. We're talking about their ongoing investigation into possible health and environmental concerns stemming from a barrel refurbishing plant in St. Francis specifically. And John, as you said, the plants that you're investigating in the Milwaukee area have been found in violation of environmental laws by the EPA, also by the state's DNR. So have the plants taken any corrective measures, or have any fines or punishments been handed down?
Well, so far we have five different governmental agencies, as you mentioned, DNR, EPA, also OSHA, DOT, and the MMSD, which is the sewerage district here in Milwaukee County, all have found violations, more than 70 to date and $116,000 in fines so far, and the investigation continues. The company has made some adjustments, though they've said that they're willing to work with EPA on some of this. However, on other cases, they are vowing a fight in terms of the violations, that they disagree with the definitions and the regulatory authority of EPA and or DNR to act in these cases. And the fines associated with DNR and EPA have not been leveled at this point. So what they've found is they've issued these notices of violation, the company's disputing them in some cases, and the fines are yet to follow. It is interesting to note, too, that the company has been has resisted some of the inspection efforts. Vis-a-vis in February, March, when they first came in, the EPA and DNR and others were stopped from entering the plant for more than an hour. They had to wait for the attorney from the company to arrive. And when they finally did get into the plant, EPA concluded that the operations were staged. In other words, they were not doing what they would typically do, and that's in violation of federal inspection rules and law, that they need to see exactly what happens when they're operating. So they went to court and got a court order, and yet still When they went back, they were detained for almost a half an hour from getting into the plant. And that's the basis of some of the complaints as well. I should note that the other concern that EPA had in terms of the health risk is EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, sent inspectors to the facility area over summer. And their own inspectors, as they were interviewing residents in the area near the St. Francis plant, their own inspectors started to feel some of these ailments themselves, headaches, fatigue, dizziness, things of that nature, and reported those. So all that led to this heightened sense that EPA needed to get in there and see exactly what was happening, and that's what resulted in the violations.
The St. Francis City Council recently met about the situation at the Mid-America plant. What came out of that meeting, Jen?
Well, so it's been years, as I mentioned, that this issue's come up, and even through the last few months, they haven't done much of anything, couldn't even bring it up at the council meeting. But after our testing came out and after EPA came out with some of their findings, that they have vowed, the city council has vowed to put it on their agenda every meeting here for the foreseeable future. The other thing that's interesting is EPA has asked the city health department in St. Francis to sort of be their quick reaction force, if you will, to go out and take air samples, because as I mentioned, EPA has done testing, but they have a need to do testing that would respond to actual smell complaints. So when smells come in, the health department will be trained by the EPA to take out canisters, negative pressure canisters, that are able to measure down to the parts per billion, and be able to take air samples and send those back to EPA to find out what is coming out. And that was what we found out so clearly in the testing that we did, is that wind plays such a huge factor, and that something it could be smelling, and operational efforts as well. What's going on in the plant? What's being sold, you know, what's being burned, and what's being, you know, dispersed at the time will have a big factor on, you know, on what's actually in the air.
Well, John, thanks for joining us, and we'll certainly be keeping track of this topic and asking you to give us an update in the future.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
John Diedrich is a reporter and an assistant editor on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigative team. He was with us for an update on a group of troubled barrel refurbishing plants in the Milwaukee area. First, when it comes to cancer screenings, most people would say, why not? But a growing group of doctors and medical experts caution that screenings can cause more harm than good in older patients. Liz Szabo is with us now. She reported on this so-called epidemic of screening as a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, where she focuses on acute care and end-of-life issues. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Being overly cautious with your health and being on top of things for getting tests doesn't seem like it would be a bad idea, but when is getting screened a bad thing?
Well, I think that's a really good question. We've had a lot of talk in recent years about when to start getting screened, getting a mammogram at 40 or 50, but really very little discussion about screening at the end of life. It's a topic that makes us all a little squeamish. None of us like to think that we're going to die ever. But experts seem to agree that if someone's not going to be around in 10 years, there's really not much benefit. They're really not going to benefit from getting a cancer screening.
You write that some doctors describe this phenomenon as overdiagnosis. Is this a new phenomenon?
No, not really. People have been worried about overdiagnosis for a number of years. The best-known example might be with prostate cancer and the PSA. The PSA blood test detects prostate cancer. But in older men especially, these cancers aren't the scary, fatal cancers that a lot of us think of. In many, many cases, in older men, like 70 and above, prostate cancers are really slow growing. They're sort of sleepy. And in a lot of cases, people say men might be better off not treating them, not even knowing they're there, because they grow so slowly. I wouldn't want to call it a cyst, but you know, it's not necessarily the same kind of scary cancer that you might diagnose in someone who's only 40.
Well, and what I found interesting was they say overdiagnosis. And at first I thought, well, why isn't it called overtesting? But it's not the tests themselves necessarily, although sometimes there are cases where that can cause problems too. But it's what happens if there is a diagnosis. And here's this person who's maybe, as you said, like in the last maybe 5 or 10 years of their life, and they suddenly have this issue come up that leads to a whole different idea of what needs to be treated and when and how. So where is that line? How do we know for ourselves or for a loved one when testing should stop for different types of cancers or other conditions?
Yeah, well, a lot of doctors say that we should really look at what is the patient's individual life expectancy and not so much just on their age. A lot of older people do not appreciate being judged on their age. You might have one person who's 75 and incredibly sick and bedridden. You might have someone else who's 75 and climbing mountains. So what a lot of people recommend, the American Cancer Society, for example, recommends in many cases, stopping screening when you think the person reasonably has, you know, no longer is likely to be here 10 years from now. And that's based on some pretty good science. If you look at mammograms, you had 1,000 women get a mammogram every year and get screened, you'd save about one life after 10 years. So you'd be screening these 1,000 women every year for a decade, and after a decade you have saved one life. So people say it tends to take about 10 years because most cancers grow kind of slowly before a test is going to benefit you, but it could harm you right away.
And how would it harm you?
Right. Well, a lot of people think, well, the PSA for men is a blood test. Big deal. I'm not afraid of a blood test. But, you know, if it comes back positive, they could end up having a biopsy, which is pretty painful. About 6% of men who get a prostate biopsy get an infection, and 1 or 2 out of 100 actually need to be hospitalized because that infection is so bad. With a mammogram, that's uncomfortable, but if it comes back positive, the woman may need a biopsy, which can be very painful and very stressful for someone who's older, especially if a woman has cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's. That can be very stressful and scary at that age.
We're talking with Liz Szabo. She is a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. And we've kind of danced around it a little bit, but there is this issue where if you tell an older person that testing them is not a good idea or isn't necessary at their age, there is that implication that it's because they're not going to be around that long. So how can a doctor or a family member broach this with an older person?
Yeah, I think it takes some diplomacy and finesse. Louise Walter at University of California, San Francisco, told me that if you just tell someone we're going to stop, that's sort of like taking something away from you, and it can be hard for someone to stop screening if they've been screening for 40 years. It's more successful if you substitute care. So if you tell them, look, you're not old enough to benefit. You're not going to live long enough to benefit from a mammogram. That doesn't go over really well. That's not going to go over well. But if you tell them, look, you know, you've got really bad heart failure right now, or look, you've got some lung issues, that's our priority. Let's prioritize what we can do to make you feel better right now, today, and not focus on something that may or may not help you in a decade. Other people have said focus on common issues, again, where you can see an immediate benefit, preventing falls. Falls are a major threat to senior citizens. Depression and loneliness. A lot of seniors are isolated. Stress and a caregiver, if they have a caregiver who's really working hard, all those things can have an immediate benefit. And if you substitute one type of care for another, it's not seen as often as ageism or giving up on them.
So really prioritizing things that could actually have a very positive impact on their life and their lifespan more than these other tests.
Absolutely.
What kind of incentives are there that make doctors keep screening patients? Because you say there are some pretty strong ones.
Yeah, I mean, there's just sort of the momentum of you've been screening for years. It's easy to just check that box, and it's people tell me it's so much easier to order a test than to spend time talking to people about why you're not going to order that test. Mm-hmm. If a doctor has to see lots of patients in 1 hour, a lot of health systems actually grade doctors on what percentage of their female patients get mammograms, for example, or what percentage get colonoscopies. So a patient may not realize this, but their doctor could be sort of downgraded if they didn't recommend these services. So that can sometimes push doctors to recommend tests that may not really be the first priority for this person.
And Liz, as we wrap up, how big of an impact does this have on the healthcare system and the cost of healthcare in the United States?
Well, it's pretty huge. I mean, I was able to find some data just on prostate cancer screening in men over 75, because pretty much most people agree men over 75 shouldn't get a PSA. That costs Medicare $145 million a year. Mammograms for women over 75 are $410 million a year. And those are just two types of cancers. That doesn't even include other cancers. So this is really an expensive habit that some people say we need to break.
Well, Liz, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Liz Szabo is a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, where she focuses on acute care and end-of-life issues. She was with us to talk about the epidemic of over-screening in older patients. Now, Baraboo resident Carrie Olson knows a lot about facing challenging situations. She's survived three different cancer diagnoses. She has dealt with two different benign tumors, one of which caused temporary paralysis, and she's gone through a divorce. And yet, or maybe because of that, she has been able to focus on living a life of gratitude. Her most recent book is titled Find Your Heart, Follow Your Heart. Get to the heart of what matters and create your abundant, authentic, joyful life. Carrie Olson joins me in the studio. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
That is quite a litany of challenges that you have faced. At what stages of your life did all of those things happen?
Beginning in my young adulthood, when I was in my late 20s, was when I had the first breast cancer diagnosis. And then these illnesses have kind of punctuated my life periodically. They've kind of cropped up all the way into my 50s.
That's pretty young to be faced with your own mortality, and not something that a lot of peers were probably really comfortable with or familiar with.
That's true. I sometimes jokingly say that I was diagnosed with breast cancer before the color pink was associated with it. There weren't many young women, young people I could talk to at that time, but breast cancer was prevalent in my family, and my mother was my mentor. She was my inspiration to keep going because she had done it herself.
I would be pretty surprised if in the midst of those challenges you were serenely finding things to be cheerful about and grateful for. When did you first start being able to look at the positive and really focus in on what mattered?
I think my personality tends to be one where I try to see the good in each situation. So interestingly, with each of these illnesses, certainly not throughout the entire experience, but at least through a portion of it, and certainly when looking back at each one, I recognize that there was good even in those really dark and difficult times. In each case, I learned some things. And one of the greatest things I learned was empathy.
Tell us more about that. How did that come out for you?
I think when you experience something that's difficult, it has the capacity to be able to open up your perspective. And so that when somebody else is going through something that's difficult, it may not be an identical situation to yours. It might not have been a cancer diagnosis, for instance. I think a part of me listens differently and opens myself up differently than I would have had I not had those experiences. I sometimes wonder who I would be without those experiences.
Well, heart figures prominently in the title of your book, Find Your Heart, Follow Your Heart, Get to the Heart of What Matters, and also in the essays collected in the book. What does heart mean to you?
I think that it has become a sign to me. I had never really thought that much about hearts until I started finding heart-shaped stones and other heart-shaped items every single day when I was out walking. And I generally, in fine weather, am walking about 90 minutes a day. And all I would have to do would be to look down, and there would be some heart-shaped stone or other item that seemed to inexplicably, mysteriously be in my path. And so I started posting photos of these things that I had been finding on Facebook. And soon I found that that became a symbol for me. And people started posting heart-shaped photos of heart-shaped mm-hmm. items back to me. And so I think that as I started examining why I might be finding all of these, the message that kept coming to me was that I needed to follow my own heart. I needed to be listening and needed to follow my intuition. I've always been of that particular mindset, but it seemed to be more dramatic over the last couple of years.
Your book is a series of short essays about different aspects of finding and following your heart and living a life that's true to our beliefs and our priorities. But you also follow each essay with questions, kind of queries for people to ask themselves. How did you happen upon that formula?
It actually came about through my daily walks. As I was starting to create the outline of this book, and I was trying to figure out what was it that I wanted to convey and what was the conversation that I wanted to engage someone else in, I decided that I wanted to use affirmations as those positive affirming statements at the beginning of each essay. And following the essay, I wanted to invite the reader to become involved. I didn't want it to be me telling my story. I wanted it to be a series of small stories that might just have some level of meaning to someone. That's maybe there was some element of it that would spark some thinking. And then invite the reader to really start contemplating questions, to be able to create what for the reader would be an abundant, authentic, joyful life.
And have you used that system of queries for yourself? Have you had revelations and realizations because of asking yourself those questions?
Yes, I have. It's been a process that's worked well for me. And so I felt that it was an opportunity to invite others to consider that same type of process.
Carrie Olson is the author of Find Your Heart, Follow Your Heart, Get to the Heart of What Matters, and Create Your Abundant, Authentic, Joyful Life. And she's with us talking about prioritizing things that truly matter to us as we start this new year of 2018. And Carrie, I want to focus on the idea of having a generous heart, in part because I think being generous is one of the best feelings that we as human beings can have. And you tell some stories about generosity that really touched you. Can you tell us about the little girl that you met who was out on the porch?
It was one summer evening that I was out taking a walk, and I saw two women and a little girl who were all sitting on front steps of a house. And so I spoke to them, and the two women spoke to me. And the little girl was probably about 4, I would have guessed, at the time. And she chose not to say anything, but instead she ran toward me. And she opened up her hand and poured into my hand some little red stones and little blue stones that obviously were precious to her. They meant something to her. So I had a little conversation with her about it, and I told her I would cherish those stones.
And she gave them to you. She wasn't just showing them to you.
She gave them to me. And there was very little conversation. She just had this generosity about her and decided that these little treasures were meant to be shared, even if they were shared with a stranger.
The questions after that essay include asking what we have to offer others. And what I really like about that is that it actually makes us focus on positive aspects of ourselves. What is special and unique that we can share with others? And that was just a really different way of looking at generosity, as not just helping others, but really recognizing what we have to offer.
I think that often we are looking for ways to be able to share our abundance with others. And that abundance can be financial, but it can also be our talents. It can be being a listening ear. It can be a shoulder for someone when they need it. That I think that when I look at generosity from that perspective, it opens so many opportunities for us to be able to share and to connect and to be compassionate and kind to someone else.
I think what I liked about that is that it really is the opposite of how easy it is to focus on our faults and the things we do wrong and our shortcomings and, you know, what we haven't quite accomplished that we meant to or wanted to. And this is turning it around. This is really looking at, as the word you use, abundance.
That's right. Abundance has become something I really focus on a lot, because so much of what I believe has been the gift in these experiences with illness has been the ability to be grateful. And being grateful and being generous, for me, go hand in hand. Because when I believe I've been so gifted to receive something, that there is a wonderful opportunity, and in some ways I feel a responsibility to pass that on to others.
We're talking with Wisconsin author Carrie Olson right now. She's the author of Find Your Heart, Follow Your Heart, Getting to the Heart of What Matters, and Create Your Abundant, Authentic, Joyful Life. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you are prioritizing what is important to you, or do the demands of everyday life push that to the side? If you ask yourself what really matters, what would the answer be? And are you looking for ways to be more generous and more grateful? Carrie might have some advice to share. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Wisconsin author Carrie Olson about her book, Find Your Heart, Follow Your Heart, Get to the Heart of What Matters, and Create Your Abundant, Authentic, Joyful Life. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you follow your heart? What does that mean to you? And where has your heart led you? Or do you wish you could focus more on what's really important to you? Carrie may have some insights to share. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Carrie, you talked about generosity and being grateful as being really linked. And let's look at having a grateful heart. When have you had the hardest time being grateful?
I think that the hardest time I had being grateful was when my mother was dying. My mother and I were very close. I was an only child, and I was close to both of my parents, but my father had passed away from a heart attack over 30 years ago, leaving the opportunity for my mom and I to share many more additional years together. And when she was dying of cancer, I was ill with my last illness, and that was a benign tumor pressing against my spinal cord, and I spontaneously became paralyzed from the chest down. I required an emergency type of surgery and 25 physical therapy sessions to learn how to walk again. And I was trying to work full time. My husband, who is extremely supportive, was doing all he could to support my mother and me during that time. But it was really, really difficult. And I write about this in the book, that when my mother was in the last hours of her life, I was struggling at how to deal with her dying. I had never been with anyone when they passed away, especially someone I loved so much. And a good friend who happened to be the director of pastoral care at our hospital in our community stopped in to see how Mom and I were doing. And as she gave me a hug, she put something into my hand, and I didn't know what it was, but I could feel something was being put into my hand. And she just looked at me with a serenity that she always has and said, "Give thanks." And as I opened my hand, I realized she had put a little brass leaf in my hand that had inscribed on it, "Give thanks." So I started to reflect on that with her because she could tell I was distraught and I was somewhat afraid because I had never been with someone in those immediate hours before death. And so she started reflecting with me on what I had to be grateful for, including the fact that I'd had a mother as wonderful as I did, that we had such a positive relationship, and that I had been given the opportunity, no matter how challenging it was in my life at that time with my own health, that I was given the opportunity to walk that final journey with her. And that was a transforming kind of experience because I had not been looking at that as a moment of gratitude at all. I was feeling very alone and feeling that there was a lot of finality there and I couldn't find the gift in it, but that short exchange with my friend was a turning point, and it has caused me to look at every difficult moment of whatever, and some of them pale by comparison to that experience, but I see almost every moment with gratitude now.
Have there been points where you felt kind of infinite gratitude for life, for the people around you? When were times when you just kind of felt like you were bursting with gratitude?
It's usually during the very ordinary moments that I feel that way, particularly when I'm outdoors. I love to walk, as I said, and so I take very, very long walks. And when I'm out in nature, I often feel almost euphoric. There's such a connection that I feel. And often I'm looking at just the smallest details, the tiniest details in a flower as I'm walking by it, or cloud formations, or whatever it might be. And those are some of the times when I feel the greatest amount of gratitude because I feel connected to something that feels infinite.
We're talking with author Carrie Olson about her book, Find Your Heart, Follow Your Heart. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. And part of the title of your book, Carrie, is Create Your Abundant, Authentic, Joyful Life. What does authentic mean to you?
Authentic for me means assessing your life in a way that you are able to live it feeling as if you are in tandem with your values, that things are all in alignment, that you're being true to yourself, that you're not losing yourself for the sake of an employer or another person in your life, that you're making decisions that when you go to sleep at night, you can feel good about.
And how do we peel away all of those things? It can be so easy to be caught up in the demands of work or the demands that family and friends we feel are making on us, or, you know, expectations of where you should be at a certain point in your life. If you're X age, you should be making this much and you should be married and have kids or maybe have traveled, you know, the world. How do we see ourselves and really drill down to find out what is important when there's so much that can kind of obscure that?
And I think that's one of the sadnesses, I would say, of our culture, in that we have created expectations often through our own judgment of our own lives, when really, if we can turn it around the other way and say, I'm where I'm supposed to be right now, and there are blessings found in where I am right now, I think it relieves some of that pressure. I think also doing a pulse check. With this particular book, it's an opportunity to take stock. It's an opportunity to look at life from a different perspective and to utilize whatever is going on in your life. If you're at some sort of a crossroads professionally or personally, that you're able to use that as that opportunity to say, here's a chance for me to start anew. Here's a chance for me to take stock. Here's a chance for me to see, am I happy where I am in my life?
And when people have not necessarily had the opportunity to do that kind of reflection, it can be a little scary, I think, you know, because when you strip away all of those different ways that we define ourselves and identify ourselves and compare ourselves, it's a little scary because you're not sure if you're going to really like the person that you realize that you are at the core.
I think that's true. And I think that's another reason why I included affirmations and why I included questions in this book, because I think we need to tell ourselves positive messages. I think it's helpful for us. And I think when we ask ourselves questions, it gives us an opportunity to really understand what those answers are.
I have to say, the reason I maybe described that very concretely was I did a study abroad program, and it was in a very different place. It was in Moscow, Russia. And you could tell, I mean, those of us that were there, you were kind of faced with who you were. You had been taken out of everything that was familiar and all the ways that you kind of relate to the world. And it was you. And you could tell the people that kind of liked who they saw in the mirror and the people that were like, I think it's time to go home now. And that was a great experience for me. I feel like I got to know who I really was at the core.
I would think that would be a real growing experience when you pull yourself out of whatever might be the comfort zone. I think that there is something very positive about that, because once again, we're meeting ourselves. And in some ways, we may be meeting ourselves for the first time or the first time since childhood, when perhaps we were more accepting of who we are.
At the start of this new year, what advice, Carrie, would you give to someone who wants to really spend some time focusing on what matters, figuring out what their priorities and their values are, and to let a lot of the other stuff kind of fall away?
I think it's in setting priorities, and it's in loving yourself enough, caring about yourself enough to spend some time in the quiet where you're not distracted by other people or obligations or other things that might be going on in your life, but to sit in the quiet and to start asking yourself some of the types of questions that I ask in this book, to give you an opportunity to really look at what you feel is important to you. And I think that it will be a process that evolves over time. Likely you're not going to get all of the revelation in just one sitting, but I think we owe that to ourselves, because in the end, we are who we are, and we are, I think, part of the gift of living is to really get to know who we are and like who we are.
And have you come to a point where you really like who you are?
I do, because so much of it is that I keep thinking how very grateful I am.
Carrie Olson is the author of Find Your Heart, Follow Your Heart, Get to the Heart of What Matters, and Create Your Abundant, Authentic, Joyful Life. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
And you can keep the conversation going at ideas@wpr.org.